Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. President Trump is taking aim at banking regulations after signing an executive order that would do away with the Dodd-Frank Act. Following the elimination of the even more important Glass-Steagall banking regulation in 1999, this could be a gift, a payday of $100 billion or more for the biggest banks. No wonder bank stock prices are rising. Donald Trump held his first phone call with Ukraine's President Poroshenko over the weekend while also signaling that he would seek cooperation with Russia in Syria. Where is the new Trump foreign policy headed? Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday, urging Britain to take a more aggressive line on Iran just days after the Trump administration rolled out new sanctions against Tehran. But first, we turn to Trump's latest executive order to aid the biggest banks and the biggest businesses. We are joined from California by Daniel Sankey, a financial policy analyst. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Thanks for joining. The Wall Street Journal reported in a recent article, and this is the words of the Wall Street Journal, the six biggest U.S. banks could potentially return more than $100 billion in capital to investors over time through dividends and share buybacks if the Trump administration succeeds in a push to loosen bank regulation. I mean, that's a lot of money. How would Trump give them such a big payday?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is a big payday. It's a huge one. And essentially what it is the Trump administration would start rolling back a lot of the regulations that currently require banks to have pretty strict minimum capital requirements. So essentially, the banks have to have cash on hand in the event of some kind of catastrophic financial meltdown, sort of like in 2008. And so since then, banks have to go under financial fitness tests, and they're required to keep a lot of this cash on hand. And banks hate doing that. They don't want to keep this money on hand. They don't want to keep this in a bank account. And if these financial regulations are rolled back, what that means is that the shareholders will get a huge payout at the expense of the overall health of the financial system. So having these big deposits, holding this cash on hand to protect the bank and the people who deposit at the bank from the impacts of some kind of serious financial downturn, instead will be used to pay out shareholders. And that's the kind of $100 billion payout that the Wall Street Journal is referring to.
David Dayan, who is an author and has written a great deal about the financial crisis and the mortgage crisis and its impact on people, he wrote an article in The Intercept. The headline of the article was, Donald Trump's executive order will let private equity funds drain your 401k. These are the first words of the article. Donald Trump's February 3rd executive order enabling financial advisors to continue ripping off their clients could prove a lifeline for a surprising beneficiary, the private equity industry. The Department of Labor's fiduciary rule would have forced investment advisors in workplace retirement plans like 401ks to operate in their clients' best interest rather than recommending high-cost, high-risk products that offer the advisors kickbacks and perks. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of insane when you think about it that there needs to be that what's up for questioning is whether financial advisors need to act in their clients' best interests, because that's essentially what they're saying is, no, a regulation that requires this isn't necessary, that somehow this is a problem. And what this is something that regulators have been trying to regulate for some time is really make it explicit for financial advisors to invest in a way that benefits their customers, that benefits their clients, as opposed to the financial advisors themselves. So they're able to invest in sophisticated instruments and complex types of investments, which actually tend to benefit the financial firm far more than the clients in the ways of fees and percentages taken. So what he's writing about in this particular interest is that the regulation is saying essentially, no, I mean, the fact that the regulation was gotten rid of is no, it's not necessary to protect our clients in this way or to have a regulation in place that's going to protect them. Instead, we can allow these financial advisors to invest in kind of whatever way they see fit. And then it's up to the clients who are not going to be protected by any kind of regulation to reap the potential downsides and economic downsides of those riskier investments, which ultimately just results in larger kickbacks for the financial advisors.
Donald Trump and the billionaire, the biggest bankers, the biggest Wall Street bankers, the biggest capitalists in America have been at war against pensions, against workers' pensions, and fewer people have pensions. They've been advocating, of course, that instead of benefits, defined benefits and pensions that are guaranteed, that pension money be invested in these 401k markets. And again, I want to go back to David Dayan and to help explain to the broader audience how this all works, or to some extent. He writes, and to break into the 401k market, especially with financial products that are high risk, high cost, and often make their money from ripping established companies apart and selling the pieces, private equity funds would need a lot of help from the advisors who guide ordinary investors in the process. And that would require the ability to offer those advisors considerable perks and kickbacks. On the same day that he issued the fiduciary rule executive order, Trump met with White House jobs panel headed by Stephen Schwarzman, CEO of the world's largest private equity firm, Blackstone. And Trump told him, "We're getting rid of your regulations," as if that's the reason that one out of every two Americans is either poor, in poverty, or near poverty, is because the capitalists have had too many regulations on them. But when you get through all of this, this sounds like just looting on a grand scale.
Absolutely. So especially with regards to pensions and retirement funds, you know, traditionally these things were created so that workers would have something to retire on, so that when they finished their time contributing to the company, they would then be able to retire more or less comfortably and live a comfortable, dignified life. And that was the purpose of pension funds. So they didn't invest in particularly complex or risky investments. They invested in very kind of stable investments that gave kind of a very guaranteed margin of growth. It wasn't huge, but it was enough to keep growing. And it was enough that the funds themselves wouldn't suddenly get wiped out because of some sort of economic swing. But what you're seeing happening now is those funds, the investment firms and the banking firms are salivating over them because there's billions of dollars in them from workers who have accumulated their money in those funds. And what they love to do is get their hands on them. But it's not just about getting your hands on them. You also have to be able to invest them in those complex and risky investments, which result in a lot of kickbacks for those advisors. So this is essentially what you're seeing here, is they want to be able to take control of those funds. They want to be able to invest them in higher risk investments, and in particular funds that directly benefit the financial advisory firms in the ways of fees and other sorts of kickbacks. So that's exactly what you're seeing now. And really that process has been going on for some time. If you look at certain places in Europe, there's still this idea of a retirement fund being kind of guaranteed funds that you get paid out with once you retire, and that really no one should be putting the possibility of you getting paid out once you retire at risk. What you're seeing now is quite the opposite. It's swinging in the other direction. And these investment firms are trying to gain control of those funds.
In 1933, FDR came into office. The U.S. government, the U.S. economy was in the throes of a deep depression. It was called the Great Depression. 25% of the workforce was unemployed. Those were official numbers, 25%. There was a global economic crisis. It led to the basic breakup of the capitalist world. In Europe, it led to the rise of Hitler in Germany, the consolidation of power of fascism in Italy. It had worldwide repercussions. And there was an understanding within the U.S. government that there are features of capitalism, the same system that dynamically, through the process of competition and making people rich by virtue of their ownership of technology and companies, that same system went to a process of overproduction. More goods were produced than could be sold for a profit. And that caused a worldwide economic depression. And that these were regular features of modern day capitalism. And it became particularly toxic in the 1930s because of the way the economy was managed. And at that time, there was what was called the U.S. Banking Act of 1933 that tried to provide a cushion or some guarantees that should these periodic capitalist economic crises take place, that the entire system wouldn't go down the drain. It wouldn't go into complete catastrophic freefall. And there was adopted as part of the U.S. Banking Act something called the Glass-Steagall Act, meaning it was designed to prevent the worst of the worst of economic banking crises. And then at the last year of Bill Clinton's administration in 1999, he signed into law a bill that got rid of Glass-Steagall. And then 8 years later, we had the 2007-2008 economic crisis. Again, the problem of overproduction. More houses had been built than could be sold for a profit. And the banks, using all of these instruments, these platforms to sell houses that could not be paid for and to give credit that could not be paid back, they torpedoed the economy once again after the Glass-Steagall Act had been repealed. In other words, investment banking and regular banking had been combined again, which had been illegal under Glass-Steagall. Now, what is Glass-Steagall? How important was it? Why did the Democrats get rid of it? And why did, even after Obama became president in 2009, was there no real, sincere, genuine effort to bring back Glass-Steagall? And if there had, would it have made a difference? Could it ameliorate or mitigate against some of the worst features of capitalist economic crises?
So there's a lot to unpack there. Glass-Steagall was a really important piece of legislature that was created during the Great Depression, when people realized how the banking industry had destroyed the American economy and cost, one in four people their jobs. And so it was created to do a number of things, to protect consumers and to protect people who were depositing their funds at banks. And there was a number of things it did, but one of the most important things it did was it essentially said there are two types of places where you can put your money. You can put your money in a bank, and a bank means that's your everyday person is going to deposit in a bank. That is a working class person is going to put their money in a bank. Maybe they'll put some of it in a savings account. They'll get a little money back from interest. And the bank is only allowed to do very particular things with your money. They can only invest it in very kind of low risk, stable ways. They can also loan it out to other people, but they have to have regulations in place that govern how they do those loans and how those loans are managed. And the idea is essentially that this will protect your deposits. And then, on the other hand, there are investment firms. And investment firms were for people who were particularly high net worth, particularly wealthy. And these firms would invest their funds in all kinds of different and more risky investments. There'd be higher risk, but also higher reward. And the idea was that wealthy people could park their money here because they could afford to take the loss. If their deposits at the investment firm were wiped out, they would still have a lot of capital in different places and their life wouldn't be materially, kind of ruined the way it would for a normal working class person if their bank account, funds were wiped out. And so it basically meant that banks couldn't gamble with investor funds in high risk investments. But when Clinton got rid of this particular regulation, it allowed banks to start doing just that, to take the funds that they had on deposit and start gambling, which is essentially why in 2008, literally banks started failing and people's funds would have been wiped out if the government hadn't stepped in with some kind of massive bailout. And so these people's funds were put at risk because they were gambling in these very complex financial instruments that involved mortgage-backed securities. This was kind of the new Democrats that came out of Clinton that were heavily backed by Wall Street. That was one of their biggest campaign contributors. And they were going to make sure they got their money's worth. And they were going to make sure they had a party that protected their interests and protected their banking interests. And that's exactly what they did. And they, for many decades, had wanted to got rid of Glass-Steagall. And this was their opportunity. This was their chance. It had been long enough that maybe people who had lived through the Great Depression were in the minority, that there were a lot of other people who, had no direct experience of that. And also that the political climate was such that the Democratic Party now was completely willing to and bending to the banking industry's needs and designs. And that's precisely what happened. In many ways, the Democratic Party is able to get through laws and policy that's just as conservative as the, you know, so-called Republican side, but they're able to do it because they have that kind of public image of being the liberal party, the party of labor, the party of workers, and that whatever they're doing must be in the interest of workers. When, in fact, especially in the case of the Glass-Steagall Act or the repealing of it, nothing could be further from the truth.
We're listening to Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. We're talking to him from California. We have about 2.5 minutes left, Daniel. It's pretty remarkable how Trump promised to, quote, drain the swamp and then loaded up his cabinet with bankers and moved now to deregulate the industry, which will be payday of $100 billion. Again, this comes from the Wall Street Journal, not a news publication that's considered hostile to the banks. Just take a minute, if you would, and review all the people tied up with the financial industry who Trump has nominated. We have Dina Habib-Powell, who heads up charitable efforts for Goldman Sachs and will become senior counselor for economic initiatives. Steve Mnuchin, I guess that's how you say his name, Treasury Secretary, also Goldman Sachs, I believe. Gary Cohn, Council of Economic Advisors. Steve Bannon, the man behind the throne, or perhaps the man on the throne. He was with Goldman Sachs. I mean, this not exactly draining the swamp.
No, not at all. And you notice the word or the name Goldman Sachs keeps popping up, and that's absolutely the case. The Secretary of the Treasury during the Obama administration, who bailed out the banks during Obama's administration, was at one point the CEO of Goldman Sachs. And so in Goldman Sachs has tremendous access to presidential administrations, whether Democrat or Republican, and they will absolutely continue to, as this administration seems to really have no significant change in that way whatsoever. So we have to understand that, you know, the economic policies that we've seen in the last, you know, 10, 15 years or so will simply continue under this particular administration, and it will be more deregulation, more laws benefiting the banks and giving them kind of privilege of access, and really kind of setting us up for another 2008 in the future. I mean, if you look at, we now understand how 2008 happened. There's a lot of great economic research and literature that's been published about it. And really, we haven't learned that lesson at all. And we are setting it up once again for the exact sort of same sort of financial meltdown and financial crisis, especially now as we're removing some of the last vestiges of regulation around the banks that the Dodd-Frank Act was able to put on them during Obama's administration.
Yeah. So, of course, from the banker's point of view, if the economy crashes again, if it, what happened in 2007, 2008 happens again, the government will be there to bail them out, as they did with $660 billion. No questions asked. They could spend the money any way they want to. Another $7 trillion in loan guarantees. So they actually had no risk. In other words, the antithesis or opposite of what we're told is the sort of the element of capitalism, that you're incentivized to get rich and so you take risk. But in fact, they don't have a risk because the government will bail them out. It's a capitalist government. But for working class folks, for the middle class, for poor people, they will pay a terrible, terrible price. We've been talking with Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst in California about the, quote, deregulation offered by Donald Trump of U.S. banks. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump held his first phone call with Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko over the weekend, while also signaling that he could seek cooperation with Russia in Syria. So which way is the wind blowing for the new U.S. administration? We are joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Welcome back, Mark Sloboda.
Brian, glad to be with you. Thanks for having me again on Loud and Clear.
Thank you for joining. Mark, talk us through the phone call between Trump and Poroshenko over the weekend. What can we learn from that conversation about U.S. policy or evolving U.S. policy toward Ukraine going forward? Do you think we'll see a continuation of the Obama policy, or are we perhaps witnessing a shift in the making?
No, I think we're definitely going to see a shift in the making. And there are numerous signals all the way from Trump's insistence at great political cost, potentially with the public and certainly within his own party and the foreign policy and security establishments, that he wants to have good relations with Russia. That is the start of it. But since he has taken office, this has only continued. The readout that the White House delivered from the conversation with Poroshenko, and it has to be noted that this conversation came a full week after his conversation with President Putin, it was very cold. It was very short, very terse, very brief, and the most that can be said of it is that he promised to work through a peaceful resolution of the Ukrainian conflict with Ukraine, Russia, and all other involved parties. There is no specific condemnation of Russia. There is no talk about any Russian invasion of Ukraine. There's no mention even of Crimea. So this certainly has the politicians in Kiev running scared. I do not get the feeling that they got a warm fuzzy out of this particular phone call. Now, for Ukrainian domestic concerns, even more interesting is that before this phone call took place, there was, according to different accounts, a meeting, an informal meeting on the sidelines of the National Prayer Breakfast between Trump and the former Ukrainian prime minister from the old Orange Revolution, Tymoshenko. She's an oligarch in the gas industry, got removed from office, launched her own campaign. She was imprisoned briefly by the former Ukrainian president, Yanukovych. She was released after the Maidan and has basically started her own party that sometimes works with the government and sometimes works against it. It's a very populist party. She has seen someone who could be put in to replace Poroshenko. Now, she says that Trump promised her during this informal meeting that Trump would not remove sanctions on Russia and that he would not abandon Ukraine. The White House denies this. They say that there was no promises made. And in fact, Poroshenko's people in Washington, who are his agents, are very upset that this meeting took place, and they actually describe it as Tymoshenko kind of ambushed Trump outside of the National Prayer Breakfast on the way to the bathroom. So, and that he simply shook her hand as he did with many other people who were there. The implications of this is if it was an arranged meeting, then the Trump administration may be sounding out Tymoshenko as a possible replacement with Poroshenko, whom it is no secret was friends with Clinton, the Obama administration, in particular Vice President Biden, but also Poroshenko and his regime had nothing nice to say about Trump during the political campaign. In fact, they actively spoke against him. So I don't think that there's going to be a lot of love lost between this Putsch regime, President Poroshenko, and the American President Trump. So it would not surprise me at all if he was looking at other players to possibly replace her. The other option is this was entirely an event instigated by Tymoshenko, and it's a sign of political desperation on her part. That's where the phone call leaves us. But of course, there was also a Trump interview with Bill O'Reilly aired just before the Super Bowl in the United States that has a lot of people talking about what he said about Russia during that interview.
Yeah, let's talk about that. In the interview right before the Super Bowl, Fox's Bill O'Reilly questioned Trump about respecting, quote, a killer, quote, that was a quote, like Putin. Trump responded by saying that America, quote, has a lot of killers, close quote, asking, quote, you think your country's so innocent, close quote. He also said that he doesn't know if he will get along with Putin, but that he respects him. With all of that we've seen in the first few weeks of Trump's presidency, where do you see the relationship going? But that's quite an extraordinary interview with O'Reilly, because you never hear the president of the United States implicating perhaps the former president, Obama or George W. Bush, the people who had gone into Iraq or into Libya, or earlier presidents. Of course, one after another has carried out the war in Vietnam, you name it, the invasion of Grenada, the invasion of Panama, the first Gulf War. the bombing of Yugoslavia. I mean, yes, in fact, objectively, the U.S. does have a lot of killers, but you never hear a president of the United States say that, insinuating that he's talking about former leaders and then comparing those former leaders to Vladimir Putin. I mean, that's wow. I mean, the whole Republican Party is up in arms about that one.
Yeah, this is shocking. This has the neocons, the commentariat up in arms. And, you know, what he was in effect saying is if you consider the Russian president a killer, to use these inflammatory words that O'Reilly did, he asked, do you respect Putin? And he's like, why? He's a killer. And Trump just kind of rolled his eyes, basically. It's huge because he is admitting that, you know, if you consider Putin a killer, well, then you can just as easily consider former U.S. presidents killers and other U.S. political leaders. And he specifically actually mentioned the Iraq war then after that as somewhere where the U.S. Killed a lot of people. So what he did here is explicitly reject the ideology of American exceptionalism. Part of this ideology, of course, says that the U.S. is not beholden to international laws. I don't think that will change under the Trump administration. But it also says that when the U.S. does bad things in the world, it's okay because it does them for a good reason, so therefore they're not bad. In the idea that the U.S. can do nothing wrong. And Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton, and then Obama became a big believer, of course, in it himself. This is a turn away from American exceptionalism and a turn to specifically in international relations realism, a realistic account of the world. He's saying Trump might, you could imagine that Trump would then continue on from this conversation saying, yes, occasionally the U.S. kills people in our national interests, the same as every other state that is out there protecting its national interests. This is a realistic take on the world. And later, the vice president, Mike Pence, on the Sunday talk shows, refused to explicitly, he was asked to explicitly say that he believes that the U.S. is morally superior to Russia, and he wouldn't say those specific words. He danced around it and said,
That's just so amazing. The American media is so amazing. If you don't say that you are morally superior, genetically superior, superior in all ways, then there's something unpatriotic about you. Perhaps you are just a puppet of an agent of a major power. I want to ask you about last week at the UN, again, discussing, I believe it was at the Security Council, discussing Ukraine and the new outbreak of hostilities in eastern and southern Ukraine. UN ambassador for Donald Trump, Nikki Haley, told the world body that, quote, the United States continues to condemn and call for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea. Crimea is part of Ukraine. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control over the peninsula in Ukraine. Now, a lot of people were wondering, well, she's the ambassador. She can't be speaking off the cuff. She can't be speaking on her own. Was she actually speaking for Trump or some other part of the White House? The White House says they knew of the remarks in advance. CNN reported that, quote, a source told CNN's Dana Bash that Haley didn't get direction from the White House, but she wasn't asked not to do it. So what, I mean, those are really conflicting signals that we're getting if what you're saying is right about a shift coming in U.S. policy towards Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, it is some conflicting signals. And there's no question that right now the Trump administration's foreign policy is all over the place. And part of that, I believe, is actually intentional, is they're putting out feelers, they're testing other governments and the figures within their own institutions and political players as well. But there are hopes that with the U.S. Secretary of State being confirmed, that he will sort of now come in and step in and produce a more coherent, consistent foreign policy. It has to be remembered that Nikki Haley has no foreign policy experience whatsoever. None. She she went on a trade mission as the governor of South Carolina. That's the extent. She has no education, no experience. She's never been in the State Department. We could discuss another time how appropriate it is her having her at the United Nations. But again, she did not confirm these exact words with the administration. But even those words, they're kind of actually taken out of context. And I would advise people to read the whole statement that the U.S. did, because she prefaced it by saying that she doesn't want to criticize Russia. the actual sentence began that way. And she went on that that the U.S. wants to improve relations with Russia. And it almost seems as if this rote denunciation of Ukraine and Crimea was lifted almost word for word from previous statements by Samantha Powers and the Obama administration, and was simply plopped down in the middle, in the absence, in the middle of her making statements, that we really actually want to improve relations with Russia. This was plopped down in the middle of it, in the absence of any overriding policy difference to the contrary, yet coming out of the White House. So I wouldn't read a lot into this. In fact, the Russian ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, afterwards said that he noticed a huge difference in tone coming out of Nikki Haley compared to Obama's ambassador, Samantha Powers, considering, of course, the differences in U.S.-Russian opinion over the Ukraine and so on. And he was actually quite pleased with it. And he had a meeting with Nikki Haley himself.
That shows there's a low bar.
A huge low bar. I mean, the relations were in a Cold War state verging on a hot war. So there's a low bar. But I still see, even out of these statements in the U.N., an improvement in tone and language. That tells you how bad things were.
Indeed. As the Kremlin said, they hope for improved relations with Trump because, quote, they couldn't be worse. Have been worse. They couldn't get any lower. So, Mark, we have about 3 minutes left. What do the new U.S. sanctions on Iran say about the prognosis for a rapprochement between Washington and Moscow? And also, of course, the characterization by General Mike Flynn and retweeted by Donald Trump, certainly supporting Flynn. But Flynn made the point that the U.S. views Iran as the number one terrorist state. Now, Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson, said, quote, Russia disagrees with a remark recently made by U.S. President Donald Trump's that branded Iran as the, quote, number one terrorist state. Russia has friendly, partner-like relations with Iran. We cooperate on a wide range of issues, value our trade ties, and hope to develop them further. So obviously, the Russians are making it clear to Trump that just because Russia, of course, wants improved relations with Trump, and Trump says he wants improved relations with Russia, they're not willing to go hook, line, and sinker with everything Trump says about all the other countries in the world, some of whom play a major role in the calculations of Russia's foreign policy, like Iran.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that there are some people in the administration that are viewing improvement of relations with Russia as part of this reverse Kissinger geopolitical gambit to try to get Russia to turn away from China and also away from Iran. And it's also no secret that there are a large number of people, not just Flynn, but Mattis and others, who have extremely antagonistic, very public feelings about Iran. And this all has to do with the way the U.S. views the Middle East through the prism of its subordinate states of Israel and Saudi Arabia, through which it controls the region. And they're both, of course, big rivals with Iran. It's absolutely ridiculous, of course, the U.S. calling Iran a big state sponsor of terror. As Russia noted, they're fighting ISIS alongside the U.S. in both Syria and Iraq as well. And they have very close relations with the U.S. installed government in Iraq. Compare that to the U.S. ally Saudi Arabia, which I don't think anyone questions is the number one state sponsor of terror. And even the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton knew that Saudi Arabia was arming both al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria. So we have to take all of this with a grain of salt. But definitely Russia is saying that we're going to disagree sometimes, and there's nothing to be done about that, and we can still have pragmatic relations and benefit other way, but certainly in Tehran, they're breathing a sigh of relief that Russia is not going to just throw them completely under the bus just because of a few nice words from Trump. But I think we're going to see some horse trading. There is no question about that. And the Russian government will keep its own national interests in mind.
Yeah, I hear you. We're out of time, Mark. I think the main objection by the U.S. government and both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, against Iran is not that they're really the number one state sponsor of terrorism, which is not true, but they had a revolution against the U.S. imposed monarchy imposed by the CIA, a coup against a democratically elected government. And the U.S. just can't forgive them for having had a revolution against a puppet regime. It's amazing. Anyway, we're out of time. Mark Sloboda, thanks so much. You are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday, urging Britain to take a more aggressive line on Iran just days after the Trump administration rolled out new sanctions against Iran and called Iran the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world. We are joined from London by political commentator and analyst Catherine Shakdam. Her latest book is called A Grand Tale of Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Welcome back, Catherine Shakdam.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for joining. Tell us about the importance of Netanyahu's visit to Downing Street yesterday for the first face-to-face meeting with Theresa May, the prime minister. How important was the timing of the visit right after Trump administration hit Iran with new sanctions?
Well, I think the timing actually it's absolutely everything here. First of all, you have to understand, I mean, this is my take on it anyway, that Israel and the UK are kind of facing the same type of political situation where they feel a little bit divorced. In terms of the UK, the UK feels a bit divorced from the EU with the whole Brexit issue. And so it's looking for new friends and political allies. And it's the same thing goes for Israel. Israel is not sitting too pretty when it comes to the EU because the EU is quite determined to get closer to Iran and actually open up new markets and kind of reinvent the way that it's thinking its foreign policy anyway towards not just Russia, but the Middle East and Iran. So Israel is kind of looking for new alliances and trying to find someone to kind of use as a cornerstone for something better and to ensure that its policy will still be kind of propelled and implemented anyway, especially when it comes to Iran. So that was very interesting timing. And I think that it kind of failed the purpose because I don't think that the UK is interested in further warmongering with Iran. If anything, Theresa May was quite clear that she wants to make sure that the nuclear deal stands and that she's not too keen on trying to be too aggressive, too belligerent when it comes to Tehran and Tehran's right to defend its border and exercise its right to self-defense when it comes to exploring its military technology. And I found this interesting. There is a shift which is happening that Tel Aviv, I don't think planned on or counted on. And it's a very interesting dynamics because even though the language, the political language is not too different in that it's still quite aggressive, it's still quite prejudiced when it comes to Iran, people are not willing to have harsher tones, even though Tel Aviv is strongly lobbying for it, but it's not happening. So even though Washington has definitely responded when it comes to the language, I'm not sure, though, that the language is going to kind of translate into actual policies. Even though Donald Trump is not exactly reliable when it comes to, diplomacy, and sometimes he just, speaks before he thinks. But I don't see anything happening. I mean, I think that Tel Aviv definitely failed in trying to promote more wars when it comes to the Middle East and Iran in particular. And I think that this visit, in that sense, was a complete failure. So, yes, you're going to see maybe some kind of more, you know, financial ties or you know, trades going to be brokered, you know, further ties will be kind of strengthened there. But I don't think that politically anything's going to happen in terms of foreign policy. And that it is actually key.
The British played a pretty major role and invested a lot in ascertaining the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is known in popular vernacular as the Iran nuclear arms deal. It was the P5+1, the Security Council plus Germany and Iran. The Trump administration and Trump, while he was candidate, Trump denounced the accord, said it was the worst. He's tweeted about it as a dumb deal and bad. But his Secretary of Defense, Mattis, who is less inflamed than General Mike Flynn against Iran purportedly and really speaks more for the mainstream of the Pentagon uniformed brass, the real centers of power within the Pentagon. And Pompeo, the CIA director, who was also hostile to Iran in the U.S. Congress, but also said in confirmation hearings, the U.S. must sustain and live up to its international agreements, referring to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now, the British also have a major historical connection to Iran. I mean, it was really under British domination. The British and the Americans collaborated together in carrying out the coup d'etat against the government in 1953, and the government that was democratically elected and that had nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as BP. And then the British and the Americans collaborated together to smash that government, and they imposed the Shah of Iran on the Iranian people for the next 26 years. I mean, when you go through the whole history and then have the narrative be Iran is the aggressor, the rest of the world, including perhaps Britain and America, are the victims. I mean, it's like shameless hypocrisy.
Oh, I completely agree with you. You know, I've written many times on that subject, trying to kind of reframe this narrative and this you know, those political dynamics within a historical perspective, because I think it's important to understand where Iran sits and why there's so much animosity, I would say, towards the West and anger, because I think that, you know, they've been betrayed by Western capitals, in particular Washington, because back then, you know, back in the 1950s, Washington was still very much perceived by Iran as this, you know, this bastion of freedom. And, you know, America was supposed to be the country to defend democracy and actually come to the aid of those who were oppressed and trying to come from under imperialism. And then they were betrayed in the most vicious manner, I would say, because, you know, for a country such as America, which claims to be, again, democratic, you know, pro-human rights, so on and so forth, to actually actively aid for the rise of tyranny and actually suppress the people of Iran for many decades and actually claim it to be right and fair and deny them their rights, their political, you know, political self-determination and their right to be, has been lived as, it's been a very difficult time. It has been very difficult for Iranians in particular to actually wrap their mind around this and understand the hypocrisy of the West. And of course, you had this alliance in between Imperial Britain and, you know, the free world, I would say, in America. So it's been very difficult dynamics, and I don't think people understand them. People are always listening to Western capitals and think that Iran is the devil incarnate without really understanding the why, because historically Iran has never declared war on any countries for, you know, I think over 100 years. It's always acted in self-defense. It has never, you know, willingly run any form of imperialistic campaign or colonialism or anything remotely similar. So you can't really, you know, when you look at the language coming out of Tel Aviv with Benjamin Netanyahu saying that Iran wants to invade the Middle East, historically not true. There is no real facts or tangible evidences, you know, trying to kind of back up this kind of rhetoric. So it's just a hear and say, and it's just completely made up. He's just making it up.
Catherine, let me read for the audience what Netanyahu actually said, because the language is, I mean, it's very pronounced, it's very dramatic. It's very hyperbolic. It's over the top, again, without evidence. Quote, this is Netanyahu about when he's talking about his meeting with Theresa May. Iran seeks to annihilate Israel. It seeks to conquer the Middle East. It threatens Europe. It threatens the West. It threatens the world. And it offers provocation after provocation. That's why I welcome President Trump's assistance of new sanctions against Iran. I think other nations should follow suit, certainly responsible nations. I mean, he's baying at the moon at this point. I can't see Britain, even though it is estranged or becoming additionally estranged because of exit with EU countries and thus must move closer to the U.S. And the U.S. is now led by Donald Trump, and Trump is identifying Iran as the number one state sponsor of terrorism. Even that government, the Trump government, which seems to be shooting from the hip, it has limitations on its authority, its power, its ability, its reach. In other words, the U.S., even with Trump at the helm, isn't about to commit suicide. And should it break the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it will be the United States that leaves it, not the rest of the countries. In other words, the United States, not Iran, will thus be isolated.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a danger here with Washington for a very long time because of the Israeli lobby has actually gone against its own national interest. And I think that the line's going to have to be drawn at the nuclear deal here, because it makes absolutely no sense on paper. Nothing, you know, no terms were violated, none whatsoever. It's very easy to come out, you know, with this kind of claim saying that Iran wants to destroy everything which is fair and good in the world. But there is no real evidences coming to back it up. So again, it's very easy to make those kind of, you know, rash statements, completely divorced from reality. It's not even rational at that point. And again, I think it's very similar to the Khartoum holding incident in the UN, where, you know, it's becoming farcical at this stage, where there's such a dichotomy in between reality and the political language coming out of Tel Aviv, where there's such a desire, you know, to again promote this idea of, you know, victimhood and that Iran wants to annihilate Israel. And I do understand that, you know, there's a certain language coming out of Iran which has been misconstrued, you know, because it just kind of fits the narrative where when people hear death to Israel, people don't understand that the translation of this should be, it's against Zionism as a political construct. It's not against Judaism, and it's certainly not against the Israeli people as citizens. It's about a political system, which we have to admit is tyrannical by definition. This is what Iran has stood for, because they actually understand what tyranny means, because they suffered from it and had to conduct a revolution to reclaim their freedom. But here again, even though Washington has systematically supported Israel in all its policies, in all its desire for war and belligerence and you know, this neocon narrative that has been, you know, sitting literally in the White House for decades now, I don't think that Donald Trump, regardless of all the brashness of his language, will do anything that would remotely challenge the nuclear deal, because he simply can't. And if you look at, for example, the Muslim, you know, this infamous Muslim ban, I think that we need to understand it in a way where actually he might have played it quite cleverly, where, you know, he did what he said he would do to kind of get this team out of everything and get people to be so outraged and shocked. And then I'm going to assume here that he knew that what he was doing was illegal, that he knew that something was going to happen to block him, and that at the same time he would save face in a way, saying, well, I've said I tried to do what I said I would do. It didn't work out because of the legalities. So maybe he's going to turn around and say, let's not do another one with the nuclear deal, because I can't exactly just, you know, spend my time in court because everything that I do is illegal. So, you know, he could be that he's actually playing. I'm refusing to believe that he's completely insane and idiotic, and that he does have some counsel on some degrees, and that they're not completely idiots as well, and that they understand that there's something called legality and that they can't just bypass it or sit on top of it just because Mr. Donald Trump decided to do so. So I think that, you know, Tel Aviv could actually be being played here, where, you know, the White House will say, well, we can't deal with this right now because we have other issues at hand, which are more pressing, and that the nuclear deal actually makes sense for America, regardless of what Mr. Trump is saying, and that it was the worst deal in history. It wasn't. America needs a new market. America needs to either get on with the program and realize that it's not living in a world where Washington decides everything, that there are other actors now playing important roles, that it already has been silent with Syria. Does it want to be completely isolated from the rest of the world and actually be completely annihilated, politically speaking, diplomatically speaking, because people will not be willing to engage Washington anymore because it's too dangerous. The language is too radical in that there is no more diplomacy anymore. He's being so brash in his statements that he's actually scaring a lot of people, including the UK, including the EU. And that, I think, will determine, you know, future policy. And I think that, you know, in this particular case, I think Tel Aviv actually banked on the wrong horse, because Donald Trump will be a political liability for Tel Aviv. And it's going to actually help maybe the conversation forward, in that a space will be created where other actors are going to have to step in and actually just change the dynamics and have a different conversation, rather than always claim that it's always the other's fault, that, you know, everybody wants to destroy Israel, when Israel is in fact committing acts of aggression time and time again, but at the same time claiming that, oh, it can just because it, you know, because it says so. I mean, it's insanity. We need to stop this psychosis where you can't criticize Israel just because it's Israel. It makes no sense. You can't just claim exceptionalism and sit atop international law and decide that international law doesn't actually apply to you, again, just because. It doesn't work like this.
That's the voice of Catherine Shakhdam. We're talking to her from London. She is a political commentator and analyst. We're talking about the meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu and Prime Minister Theresa May. We have about 3 minutes left, Catherine. Before Netanyahu's arrival, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said Theresa May must make it clear to the Israeli Prime Minister that the British government will stand unequivocally behind the rights of the Palestinian people, along with the many who support them in Israel, as well as human rights and justice across the region. Did she do that?
There's a lot of grandstanding here. You know, I think it's something that, you know, UK prime ministers have said many times over. Whether they mean it or not, I'm not sure. I don't think so, because, you know, so far they have done nothing to prove that they actually care about human rights issue and the rights of the Palestinian. That being said, it could be a signal that, you know, there will be changes now in terms of policies, in that you can't continue. You can't have outrage over the Muslim ban, for example, and then, you know, people stay quiet over the illegal settlements and Palestine being under vile occupation. So I think that politicians are understanding now that so much has happened and so much has been said that they need somehow to find a way to have some consistency in their language, because people are catching on. You know, there is such a thing as the internet, where people have access to information and they don't listen to CNN, whatever fake news is coming out of the BBC. And, you know, they're going to have to play the real game. They're going to have to be held accountable, because I think that more and more people are becoming aware of what is happening, because I think they were so shocked by what Donald Trump did and how he actually kind of, you know, showed up in the White House. They didn't think it was possible. The, you know, fascism has a new face now. And I think that people are quite scared that it's actually coming to Europe as well. So there's a bit more scrutiny when it comes to what politicians say and what they do. And I think that Theresa May actually sensed it and is getting ahead of that. So she's gently telling Israel that, yes, we're still your friends, but at the same time, we're not going to be supporting you blindly and trying to cover for you systematically, because it's actually damaging our own standing in the world. And we're actually, again, losing ground quite rapidly, not just in the Middle East, but with the EU as well. I mean, Britain's going to need to reinvent itself politically, diplomatically, and economically. It's very difficult to do. So I think that now they're going to be trying to think more carefully, more strategically. And whether they like it or not, they're going to need countries such as Iran. Iran is definitely the future when it comes to market. Iran is, you know, virgin territory, and so much money could be made that Britain needs. So strategically speaking, Iran makes much more sense than Israel. So I think you're going to see, you know, interest will shift, and we live in a world, you know, where capitalism rules. So I'm quite interested in to see how, you know, the political world is going to kind of follow up and you know, operate a shift towards Iran and say, well, you know, then maybe not that bad after all, because there's a lot of money to be made there. So let's try to see if we can be friends with them for 5 seconds. And that would mean a greater distance from Israel. And that could be a good thing, because then people will realize that, yeah, nothing happened.
Yeah.
You know, the world's still spinning, and then, you know, nobody got annihilated at all.
Yeah, I hear you. Yes, of course, Iran is a country of 80 million. By comparison, Israel is a small place. We've been joined by Catherine Shakhdam. She is a political commentator and analyst. Her latest book is A Grand Tale of Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.